Welcome back to Community Voices on NPR Illinois 91.9 UIS. We continue in the year-end drive, speaking to some of the friends of the station, getting to know them, and also asking for your support. So before we get started with today's guest, Kelly McEvers, I'd like to ask you to go to nprillinois.org, click on the donate button at the top right, and you can make a gift. It takes a couple minutes with your credit card, and it's really simple. So if you would prefer, you can call 206-9847 and make your gift. I mentioned our guest is Kelly McEvers. Kelly, you've heard nationally on NPR with All Things Considered and a variety of other programs in the past. She right now has got more interesting assignments that she's working with. And I guess, Kelly, well, I'll just ask you to introduce yourself if you don't mind.
Yeah, hey there. It's good to be here. I was just home visiting family in Illinois and set my station to NPR Illinois like I always do. So it's good to hear you guys on the radio and good to be talking to you now. I am now the host of a podcast. It's called Embedded. So we do long form documentary type stories about stuff that's in the news, basically. And then, you know, a lot of times those stories will also appear on the radio. So it's not that I've totally disappeared from the radio and gone digital. We spend good chunks of time working on single issues. Right now, we're in the process of revisiting our series about Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is very much back in the news. The question of whether he remains the Senate Majority Leader in Washington is one that is hanging over many things, I think. And the question of what his relationship will be like with President-elect Joe Biden is a big one. So we're revisiting that, doing some new content around that right now.
Excellent. Yeah, and I saw some of the coverage you did is really around how much he likes open donations and keeping as much money going into the Senate as possible.
He taught a class. There's a great quote in the series. He was teaching a class in politics in Louisville, Kentucky, his hometown, and walked into the classroom and said, you know, the three things that you need to succeed in politics are money, money, and money. It's a great quote. It wasn't one that we got. It was a great investigative journalist named John Cheeves in Kentucky who got that quote. But it's just, it's really telling. Yeah, he realized very early on how important it is to have a lot of money in politics because money helps you win, is his point. It's a very simple point. In particular, his main rival on this, as we reported, and it's really interesting rivalry over the years, was John McCain. The two fought about it for decades and decades. John McCain wanting more campaign finance reforms, Mitch McConnell wanting fewer. Of course, in the end, I think, you know, you could say Mitch McConnell and his camp won with the passage of Citizens United almost 10 years ago. And, you know, there's more money flowing into politics than ever before. His own Senate race this year, he and his opponent spent $110 million on that race. She actually outspent him and he still won. But, you know, there was a so-called dark money contribution made to a PAC, a political action committee that's affiliated with his campaign. It was more than $50 million. We have no idea who that person was. We don't have any idea where that donation came from. It's just an organization called One Nation. So this is the kind of stuff we're talking about. We're talking about money in politics. People don't think about it. People don't care about it that much, I think. But when you say it like that, it's just like, whoa, what? Yeah, $50 million is a lot of money. That's a lot of money. Where did it come from? Who is it? Well, as Jane Mayer, investigative reporter for The New Yorker, says in our series, she's written a whole book about this. You know, the people who receive those donations, they know who it's coming from. They know who it is. It's just that we don't know who it is. We, the public. And, you know, one of the reasons we have laws about this stuff in the first place is that we should, there's a thought that we have the right to know. And that's not the case anymore. So, I mean, it's an interesting issue. It sounds kind of boring and wonky, but it's actually like a thing that really affects all of our lives.
I think you were just getting Embedded started the last time you visited us. And your first story, I believe, was about healthcare and the outbreak of HIV down in the Evansville area.
Indiana. Yeah.
To hear people talking about sort of a, I don't know if you call it a safe house, but and how it sort of emerged. And that was one of the first things we heard before the Indiana governor got nominated for vice president.
Mike Pence was governor of Indiana at the time. It was 2015. There was an outbreak of HIV in the United States of America in 2015. I mean, it was one of those things, and this is sort of how the show got started. It's one of those headlines that you read on like page 14 of the paper and you just go, what? How did that happen? What is going on? How is this possible? And, you know, it was a complicated set of answers to those questions, but our sort of idea at the time we started the show, and still is our idea now, is we always, you have questions. You read a headline, you have questions. So our thing is we go to the place and just try to kind of answer those questions in the place, right? That's kind of where the idea of Embedded came from, or the name Embedded. Yes, we went to Indiana and spent some time in a house where people were struggling with addiction to this one particular opioid, which was one that was unfamiliar to us too. We just hadn't heard of. It's a Opana, a very, 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 very strong pain medicine often used on cancer patients. And people were getting these pills on the street and then, you know, cooking them and cutting them and injecting them and sharing needles, because the possession of a needle in Indiana at the time was a crime. I mean, that's not the only reason. It's not like everyone said, you know, but like that was, you could sort of look to that as one reason why this was happening. Needle exchanges were not common. They were in fact discouraged. And so, I mean, that did change, but it was only after health officials from around the country came into Indiana and said, listen, this is a big deal. This is going to happen not just in this county, but it's going to happen in other counties too if you don't get a handle on this and start to, you know, work with people and talk about addiction services instead of just criminalization of this problem.
Did you see parallels to his guidance of the COVID task force with some of the things you learned on that project?
Fascinating. I don't know. I mean, we honestly, because we were so on the ground, like we didn't do a ton of like time in the Capitol. I always wanted to go back and do a follow-up about this, like a really good TikTok of like how exactly his decision-making went. We were not really focused on the politicians at the time. We've done a little bit more of that since 2016, just because we felt like it was kind of all hands on deck starting in 2016 with how politicians think and what politicians do. So we didn't do it as much then. But my sense was that it was very much for him with a moral and religious issue. I think the idea of needle exchanges, you know, just didn't feel like the right thing to do. And I think a lot of health officials were then able to talk and say, listen, this is, we know that this works. We have data, right? That this is actually an effective thing to do. It's what's right for the public. So yeah, hard to make the comparison just because I haven't done the reporting on the coronavirus task force. I mean, for a while I was also hosting a daily podcast about the coronavirus for several months early on in the pandemic. So this is a thing that I was watching a lot more closely at the time. But you know, I mean, the coronavirus task force, like, you just don't, you know, there was a time when they were front and center. We were getting briefings all the time. That's just not the case anymore. I don't know if I can make a comparison to that time in Indiana, but I can say, you know, I think a lot of people would agree that there isn't a lot of federal leadership on this anymore. And I think that's been deliberate, right? It's on the part of the administration to say, let's let the states handle it. And that's the way it's going to be. And I think there are some people who would say we need more than that.
Well, you are listening to Community Voices on NPR Illinois 91.9 UIS, and we have a very special guest with us today, Kelly McEvers. And as you can see, she's taken a deep dive into some really interesting stories that I haven't even thought about or would have even thought about putting together. So you can continue to support programming and reporting and stories like this so we can take a deep dive into things for you so you don't even have to think. So give us a call at 217-206-9847 or go to nprillinois.org. Now, Kelly, I want to come back to talking about the podcast, but for those of us who may not be as familiar, can we take a dive back to Lincoln, Illinois? I kind of want to know what it was like growing up there. I've never been to Lincoln, even though we're so close to there.
So my dad worked in the Department of Corrections, Illinois Department of Corrections. And so I was born in Southern Illinois when he worked at a prison down there called Vienna. And then we moved up to Central Illinois for him to take over as warden at the Logan Correctional Center. There was only one prison there at the time. Later there were two, Logan and Lincoln. So we moved there in 1977. I remember I was really sad about it because it was a new place and I didn't want to leave my hometown down south. I had a Southern accent when I moved to Central Illinois. I was Kaylee McCabers. And I quickly did not have one because I didn't totally fit in. But yeah, no, I went, you know, Lincoln, I have so many good memories from Lincoln. My parents don't live there anymore, so I don't get to like go back like some people do back to the hometown. My parents moved away from Lincoln. They're still in Central Illinois. When I was in college. So I don't get to go back as often, but I still go to all my high school reunions, which I love. People hate high school reunions. I totally love them. I'm just like, please tell me all the stories. I had such an incredible amount of like extracurricular activities. Like I was in a jazz band when I was sixth grade. You know, I learned to like improvise, like, I mean, it sounds totally dorky, you know, but like, I like was on the speech team in high school. We did tons of theater. Like I did all the sports. Like there was just so much to do in Lincoln as a kid that I loved it. It was great. I also, when later in life, when I came back from the Middle East, did a story about Lincoln and sort of used it as a way to do a story about, you know, the disappearing middle class and growing inequality in this country. And boy, did that not make me a lot of friends in Lincoln. Talked about, you know, people struggling with addiction. I was like on a ride along with the police when they were doing a drug bust. And people in Lincoln were really mad at me for like not seeing the place for what's good about it. I don't think that was the point of the story. I think the point was just to talk about how the world has changed. And as somebody who had lived abroad, I had been away for so many years and came back and noticed, wow, things are not the same as they used to be in this country, right? And I was seeing, just trying to do that story through the lens of my hometown. So, you know, like a lot of places, it is totally struggled. I mean, when you don't have manufacturing jobs anymore, when you don't have just a certain like income level for a certain number of people, towns change, you know, and they struggle with stuff. Lincoln, though, is like one of those towns, though, that has done really well in a bunch of ways and has struggled in others, like most towns in America. So,
yeah, it sounds like your time in the Middle East might have inspired you to come back and do some really investigative reporting. What was your experience like that there?
Amazing. It was the best. I started out in Saudi Arabia. I moved to Baghdad. I lived in Istanbul. I reported in Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, the Gulf. We eventually moved to Beirut, lived there. I reported in Egypt. So yeah, I mean, it was like one of the most incredible experiences a reporter can have. And during that time, of course, one of the most incredible stories of a lifetime was unfolding. And that was the Arab Spring, which was, you know, it's hard for people to remember it because I think people think of that place as just a place where there's war and unrest. But, you know, this was a thing that started as just tens of millions of like 25-year-olds in the streets protesting, like a lot of people were this summer here in this country, right? It started as protests, people who were fed up with the way things were and wanted something different. And in a couple places it worked. Tunisia, you know, there was a peaceful transfer of power. The leader stepped down. There were elections. In other places, authorities responded with violence. And then things devolved into some of the unrest that we're still seeing today. I mean, that is how the Syrian civil war started. It was a protest movement, first and foremost. I think the leaders would dispute that because they like have their own narrative of that, of what happened, but that's what happened. That was there. So yeah, so it was one of the greatest stories of a generation until it was one of the hardest stories to see that much violence inflicted on people and by their own governments was really, really hard and super dangerous. And it's one of those stories that as a foreign correspondent, you definitely have you recognize that it's a privilege to tell those people's stories and that at some point you have to sort of pass the baton to someone else and let them tell the story, because if you do it for too long, it will be really hard and it's really dangerous. So, you know, so at some point I just had to come home.
You had to talk yourself into that, really.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you actually do a piece or a documentary of how to get yourself out? Should you get yourself out?
Yes, for sure. I did a whole hour-long documentary, an audio documentary, and then still didn't want to leave. Like, I called all these people for advice who were like, you don't have to do it forever, you know? And I was like, I still didn't want to leave. I mean, and there's a lot wrapped up in that, right? It's like so complicated, and you think it's really uncomplicated at the time, where you're just like, no, but I have to tell the story, you know? So there's a lot of ego in that, and it's kind of yucky, and you have to sort of work on that a little bit, I think, in order to convince yourself that, like, you're not the only person who can tell the story. There are other people who can tell the story. There's other stories to tell, right? And I think it was coming back home, and that was, you know, 2014, just thinking about inequality and the way our economy has changed, and the way a certain swath, several swaths of the population feel disenfranchised. And what is that going to mean? I was seeing that in 2014 when I came home. And then, like, you know, obviously who knew what was going to happen in 2016, seeing that and realizing, like, oh, there's been this major shift in our country. And that really made me feel engaged with this place and wanting to report on this place. I did not foresee 2016. I think others did. And I think we're all learning a lot of lessons now. And I think the conversation continues. I feel very lucky to be still a journalist working in this country and to have to be part of that conversation and elevating those conversations and being a part of the national dialogue, right?
When and where did you initially get the journalism bug? And I do think it's a bug, right?
Totally. Oh my God. Yeah. I'll never do anything else. Like, unless I will, but I'm always like, I'll just do this job until I like get really tired. which Syria almost wore me out, but no way. Totally at University of Illinois at the Daily Illini. Bill Clinton was president. Hillary Clinton was coming to campus to speak. And a friend of mine was like, oh, I'm going to the speech. And I was like, oh, cool. She's like, no, I'm going to cover it for the paper. And I was like, what? How do you do that? I thought it was just like, I was like, oh, that's cool. And she was like, oh yeah, it's a student paper, but it's independently run. So it's independent of the university. It's like, it's, you know, it makes its own money. So it's like not tied to the university, and they'll try anybody out. That was the thing, right? It's like, you can just walk in the door and try out. And then if they like you, like, you'll get paid. And I was like, that's good news, because I need a job. I'm broke. So I went in the door, like, you know, soon after, and they assigned me a story. It was like a little press release about something about Section 8 housing and how the number of units of Section 8 housing was going to be, I don't even know. Like, I mean, I think it was about like how the number of Section 8 housing units was going down in the county. And we were like the morning newspaper. So like, I was like, oh, I'm gonna go report this story. And of course, like, way over reported it. I ended up spending a night in a homeless shelter that night, or maybe the next night, which is like not totally relevant to the story. You know what I mean? Like, and then I came back and I was just like, you guys. And then like, I wrote this, I'm sure, I always tell the story, and I know it's going to backfire on me someday, because somebody's going to find the story and read how badly written it is or badly reported it is, because I'm sure it was garbage, but it was on the front page. And that was that. Like, I was just like, I can go in the world, find stuff out, and then tell people about it and you're going to pay me. Like, I was just like, it was so simple, but that was exactly, I was like, that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. Like, I was just, that was sold from day one, that's what I wanted to do. And again, there's some ego issues in there for sure. Like, and I think all journalists need to think hard about that, right? Like, why do we do this stuff? And I've been thinking about it a lot lately too, in terms of my own show and some of the reporting we're doing. We're doing a series about policing, and can the police, 18,000 police departments around the country, we've done a lot of reporting on policing in the past at Embedded, a lot. And so now it's like, can you really remake 18,000 police departments? It is a daunting task. And so we're really looking for stories that will surprise and challenge people and make them think, right? And I'm thinking really hard about, you know, stepping away from the microphone a little bit and letting other people tell the stories or host the stories, or So stay tuned for that. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do it, but I feel like there's ways to use your position and still do great journalism, but also, you know, I think this is a moment where giving other people the opportunity to tell stories is a thing to do. So I'm super psyched about doing that.
Why do you think it's so important to get these different perspectives and I guess different narratives?
I'm white. Like, I'm not gonna tell the story this about police the same way as my Black colleagues are, as people who have experienced being in this country in a totally different way as me. I mean, I wanna be really blunt. That's why I think it's important. I think we've been telling stories from a very particular like white middle-class perspective for a pretty long time in this field. And we have to figure out ways to not do that. If I can just be like super straightforward, like that's the way I feel.
Well, Kelly's been kind enough to join us here during our year-end version of Community Voices. And we're asking people to support NPR Illinois so we can continue to bring you interviews like this, news information, both from NPR through international and national reporters, but also locally and state-based here from NPR Illinois. It's all really important for us understanding what's going on and for holding our government accountable. And you can make it happen. Make sure we have enough journalism firepower by making a gift at nprillinois.org or by calling 206-9847.
Now, Kelly, how are you coping with coronavirus? I know you said you're doing a little bit of trying to go to a warmer place, but how have you been staying like sane and like entertained during this time?
It's a hard time to complain about how difficult things are, again, when so many people are struggling in so many ways. So for the most part, I have a job, I have the internet, I have a roof over my head, I have an 11-year-old child who's not in school at all. Los Angeles school district, entire school district, haven't been in person at all, not going to probably anytime soon. Totally support that decision. So many families, right, at risk. And my kids doing like amazingly well with remote learning. So I've got a pretty good situation. That said, it's like, it's just super hard. It's hard. It's hard to not see, you know, I've seen my family. I've seen my parents. Can't hug them. Can't go inside. It's been really cold sitting on my mom's like screened in porch and when it's like 27 degrees in Illinois. And we're like wearing our like blankets and like multiple coats. And you know, there was a minute when I was like, am I really going to drive 10,000 miles to see my parents and only be able to sit outside? And I thought, no, that's crazy. But then I realized, yeah, I'm going to do that. It's what's important. It's important to be with your family. I live in California, so we can be outdoors a lot, which is great. Like we can do stuff outdoors still, right? We can still go surfing. We can still go camping. So again, like I'm like the luckiest person in the world. I think the idea is, well, I think for me, like part of it is also just like leaning back on what I know, which is being a journalist. Like my way of giving to the world is to just try to provide like honest and sober reporting on a thing that is really hard for a lot of people. And then using whatever time and space I have to help out in other ways too, right? I mean, that's the only way to get through it, I think, for me.
Well, Kelly, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And is there anything else that we should ask you or would you like to tell us about?
I want to tell everyone to support NPR Illinois. And because what I think that we say this on our show, everybody who works on my show Embedded has experience working at an NPR member station. All of us have done that before. And I think what listeners may not know is that supporting the local NPR member station, that support comes all the way through the system, right? That support makes my show possible. I could not do this kind of journalism where we spend several months on a series about how to remake the police, which I think is going to be is really important work, right? And it's a hugely important conversation we're having in this country right now. And talking about the ability to like look for new voices to tell those stories, the time and the space and the money to do that is because people support stations like yours. So like, I cannot just be like, I'm just going to be like, I'm going to say this as strongly as possible. Support this station. Supporting the station is everything. It is a tough time for everyone. You know, we are not rolling in money in the public radio system right now. So anybody who can do whatever they can makes a huge difference in our lives and makes the journalism that we do possible. So that is what I want to say. And I want to say thank you to you guys for having me.